Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with Brian Laidlaw about his new book, Erratica, on climbing, language, and touching stone. After he climbed El Capitan, he found himself facing a repeated question. So what was it like up there? Beginning with this seemingly simple question, he searches for the perfect metaphor, traveling from the erratics of his youth in California to the towers of his current home in Moab. Along the way, he beckons us into a community bound as much by narrative as by rope. Brian Laidlaw is an author of two collections of poetry, The Mirror Maker and The Stuntman. A songwriter and musician, he's released several albums, most recently This Aster. He writes for outdoor magazines, including Outside, Climbing, Alpinist, and Orion. Based out of Moab, he moonlights, often literally, as a rock climber. Brian Laidlaw, thanks for joining us.
Oh, man, so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Are you joining us from Moab?
I am indeed.
Okay.
Yeah, in my little office.
All right. How are things in Moab today?
Lovely. This is a very special time of year. It's starting to ramp down temperature-wise and starting to be habitable out there. So getting back out on the rocks and getting out on trails, it's a great time to be alive.
I want to start with your preface. We'll skip around a bit as we go along, but sure. I was, as a non-climber, I don't know any of these terms, but I'm intrigued. That's part of the book. I want to learn this community and this life. We'll get talking about risk as well. Your chapter 3 will spend some time on what risk brings you, right? And and I say that as a person who's very risk averse, and I have an anti-bucket list. You'll never find me on El Capitan, but I'm curious. So some of these terms, you say in the preface that you want to make sure that this book is for a lay audience, right? But it also climbers might want to pick it up, and so to them, you're establishing your bona fides here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's funny, there is. I think that everybody's experience with climbing is completely valid, from, you know, the rawest beginner to the most seasoned pro. But I do think that as you get deeper into it, you become, I don't know, you develop a more and more refined sense of what's going on in your body as you're reacting to the climbs that you're climbing. And I think, it felt important at the start of the book to make it clear for the pro climbers, I hope, who will come across this book, that I'm not just making it up, that I've really like put in my time, and that, you know, I've developed a certain level of expertise in this, you know, like learning this language, basically. And probably I'm like medium hard climbing, you know, I'm a very good amateur climber. I'm nowhere near strong enough to be a professional climber. Oddly enough, though, the sport has advanced so much that if I were climbing as hard as I am now, back in the late 90s or whatever, when I first got into climbing, I would count as very good, you know, but the level of the sport has been pushed so far that like climbing V10 is like a bouldering difficulty level that, like, when I first started, V10 was a big deal. And now I can climb V10, but other people can climb V17, V18, which is like astronomic. It's funny to try to, I don't know. It's funny to insist, like, no, I really do know what I'm doing, but I do.
So tell me about, you talk about sending a route.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
Yeah. So, send is short for ascend.
Oh, okay. All right.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It's common climber slang, climber terminology. In climbing, there are these rules where, like, it doesn't count, or in some contexts, it doesn't count just to get to the top of something. You have to do it, like, in a certain way, which is to say, like, not having gotten any assistance from the rope, and you need to do it cleanly from the bottom to the top without pausing. And, you know, you can't, like, if there's a boulder where you can do a handful of moves and then drop back to the ground and then pull back on in the same spot and go up to the top from there, that actually doesn't count as sending. And it's kind of funny to be like grown-ups talking about these little rules about, like, no, you didn't do it right or whatever. Sending is when you really do it and you get the gold star of, like, yes, you really sent, you really ascended. Yeah.
You say one of your bona fides, I can one arm hang a 20 millimeter edge. I get nervous just reading that. What you're hanging One armed. Okay.
Yeah, fortunately, just in my home, you know, there
Oh,
these are
okay.
like funny, yeah, funny training metrics. I mean, I'm sure I've one arm hung 20 millimeter edges outside too, but you know, climbers have all this goofy gear that we use to like make our little fingers strong. And so over the last couple of years, that was like one of my sort of training goals, was building up the finger strength by lifting smaller amounts of weights and like hanging on these things with, you know, weights hanging from my harness and stuff like that. Yeah, all in the pursuit of just like cranking on these little tiny holds.
So what's trad climbing?
Great questions. Traditional trad is short for traditional
Okay.
climbing. So sport climbing, like the type of climbing that you'd see at the climbing gym, there are bolts already like put in the wall or, you know, in the rock. And then as you're climbing, you're clipping your rope into those things that are permanently fixed to the wall. In contrast, traditional climbing is when there's no permanent gear in the wall. You just walk up to a rock face that you know, hasn't been altered, and you're climbing up, and you have these little like mechanical devices, either little metal widgets or little camming devices that you put into cracks or fissures or whatever in the rock that you clip your rope to, and if you were to fall, they would catch you. But then the person who's following the route, your partner, climbs along and cleans them, takes them back out of the rock, so that when you leave, it's like a leave no trace kind of passage. You know, there's no fixed gear.
Then, of course, I think we can visualize free climbing, no ropes.
Yeah, so this is one of the confusing technicalities. Free climbing, we don't have to go too far down this rabbit hole, but free climbing is when you are using your hands and feet. You actually are allowed to have a rope when you're free climbing. It's free soloing that has no rope. And then to further muddy the waters, the opposite of like free climbing is when you're aid climbing, which is when
Oh.
instead of just using your fingers and toes, you're like allowed again to like put little pieces in the crack and then actually like pull up on them with your hands. So you're not just using the rock, you're using like you're aiding your way up. And so you know, Alex Honnold famously free soloed El Capitan. I did not even free climb El Capitan. I aid climbed El Capitan, which is what most climbers do. They're like putting little stuff in the cracks, and then because it's like too small to get your fingers in there, so you're like putting little things in the crack and pulling on them and stepping in slings, and you know, it looks like you're cheating, but it's allowed. Yeah.
I don't want to dwell too much on me, but I watched that thing of Alex Honnold, and even though I know he made it, I'm still nervous of the video of him going up.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I have seen that innumerable times. I find it so inspiring. And I do. I mean, what I'm doing is at such a lower level of difficulty than what he's doing. The free soloing that I'm doing is just completely trivial by comparison. But it gives me at least an understanding of the possibility of feeling basically safe up there. Like I can imagine him mostly feeling okay while he's doing it, because I feel mostly okay while I'm doing my like rudimentary version of it. If it's, you know, enough below the threshold of what counts as really hard for you can feel, and if you've rehearsed the heck out of it, I think it's possible for it to feel medium good. But yeah, it's terrifying to watch.
Let's jump into, I think the chapter that fascinated me the most was the chapter on risk, chapter three. It's called Going Up and Going In. Let me start just the beginning of the chapter here. Your parents would repeat this mantra to you, the you're a careful boy. But you were very risk averse as a child. You could describe yourself as kind of afraid.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it was, I mean, it was not even that I was scared of stuff. You know, I wouldn't say that I was a timid kid. It was more that I felt like I was supposed to, I was very aware of what constituted good behavior, and I wanted to exhibit good behavior. And I understood that like it's good behavior to look both ways before you're crossing the street. I understood that like, you know, I did spend a lot of time in the Sierras, especially growing up. And was, as a little kid in situations where there was like quite a lot of exposure, on cliffs and things like that, where there's like exposure where you could fall off. And even as a little kid, I knew to like stay well back from the edge. I wasn't like leaning over the thing. And yeah, that funny feedback from my parents that was like, yeah, we so appreciate that you're so careful. It's like they didn't have to worry that I was going to run out into the street and get thumped by a car or whatever. And I felt proud of that ability to, like, I guess proud of that situational awareness or something. Yeah, it has been a slippery slide since then. My parents are reading the book now, and my mom was sending me some texts while she was reading the free soloing chapter. I was like, I don't feel very comfortable with this one. She's very complimentary of the book,
Right,
but
right.
yeah.
You've written poetry, you're a songwriter, musician, etc., a broad life outside of climbing. Well, let me just ask you open ended, how did you get into climbing?
Yeah, great question. So there's a couple answers. My grandfather, who features prominently in the book as well, was a climber in the 1950s with the Sierra Club's rock climbing section. He was the accountant for the Sierra Club, and he was also Ansel Adams's personal accountant, which is pretty rad. So he was involved, in climbing culture, and he would have said, oh, I wasn't doing anything very cutting edge. But at the time, he's climbing in hiking boots and on hemp ropes that really wouldn't hold a fall in all likelihood. So it was pretty extreme, even though he was quite humble about it. But when I was a little kid, he took me out climbing, when I was probably 4 or 5, climbing in like a swami belt, which is when, you don't, it's not a proper harness. It's just like some slings tied together. And he taught me how to rappel using like the mid 1900s friction rappelling technique, where you don't have a harness either. You just like run the rope between your legs and over your shoulder, and the friction of the rope on your body is enough to control your descent and whatever. So I climbed with him up in the Sierras when I was very little, and it was just kind of like bopping around and getting familiar with the systems a little bit, and developing some intuitions just with like how granite works and how your hands and feet interact with it. Then I did some, rock climbing birthday parties and stuff when I was a little kid, 7, 8, 9. But really, it wasn't until moving to Minnesota in, maybe 15 years ago to do a master's. I did an MFA in poetry at the University of Minnesota. And the weather there was so brutal that I started climbing in the climbing gym on campus. And just like that's sort of where I think of my current climbing journey as beginning, was like that round of time in the master's program, and then climbing in the great little gyms in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And then after that, I moved down to Denver. I was living in Boulder doing a PhD at the University of Denver, and started climbing outside a ton. And that was sort of like when, I first started really pushing the difficulty and feeling like I was starting to do sort of like significant climbing, when it became more central to my life.
So in Minnesota, famously flat, right? You encountered this gentleman who was becoming an ex-paraglider, right? Extreme sports. And he was telling you about some friends of his, including his brother, I think, who went in. What does that mean? Went in.
Yeah, so this is a euphemism that I had heard around a number of times. It means dying, and it's used less frequently in climbing, and it's used quite a lot more with like base jumping and paragliding, wingsuiting, that kind of stuff. So yeah, I was overhearing people in those communities saying like, oh yeah, so and so went in. And it sounds so gentle that I didn't really pick up from context clues at first that it's a way of saying that someone has passed away. But yeah, that's and th this guy who I met in Minneapolis had, a dozen friends die doing that kind of stuff. At the time when I lived in Minnesota, that I was not yet sort of like in the more extreme part of the climbing community. And now living here in Moab, I hear about people going in kind of a lot. And fortunately, knock on wood, it hasn't been super close friends of mine, but certainly people who are very close friends of my friends, Being in this place where people are really pushing the limit risk wise. It's part of the conversation all the time.
So, we didn't talk. This whole chapter is about risk and what risk gives you, right? And you're risking your life in some of these cases. So you say one of risk's most obvious gifts is thin slicing acuity, where we separate each millisecond. Each separate millisecond stands out like an image etched in stone. Tell me about that, and then maybe some of the other gifts that risk gives you.
Yeah, for sure. This idea of thin slicing is a really wonderful image that I came across in a number of different, both sort of like first person accounts of climbers and mountaineers, and then also some sort of more like scientific psychological books about risk. I think for me, my background is in poetry, and so I am really drawn to the energy of like an extremely vivid individual moment that's laden with meaning and that's poignant and that's fully embodied and that remains with you forever. I mean, I think that that's what poems are kind of trying to document often is the currency that they operate in. And so when you're in that sort of thin slicing, hyper-focused place where you feel time dilating, all of those embodied memories become indelible. I mean, the sort of hardest and most dangerous climbs that I've done, I mean, it's no exaggeration to say like I can still, however many years later, remember like the individual texture of individual crystals in the individual handholds, the like the finest little ripples of these really tiny little features of granite or sandstone or limestone, whatever I'm on. And when your life depends on interacting with those surfaces flawlessly, you're present with a level of attention that is unrivaled anywhere else in life, and unrivaled even by serious climbing on a rope when you're safe. And I think the blessing that you get from putting that much attention into the moment is that then your mind retains, your mind just soaks up every little facet of the experience, and then it's in there forever. It's in your body forever.
So you, as you said before, you're not thinking about death up there. You're not thinking about there. It's such intense concentration.
That, yeah.
That's where your mind is, I guess.
Yeah, and I think if I ever feel scared on a climb, I've definitely done something wrong, I would say. In terms of my own, there are other climbers who are interested in being scared. And for me, if I'm doing something dangerous, it's always something that I've rehearsed a lot on top rope. So a lot of what I like doing is like first ascents of highball boulders, these like tall, 30-foot boulders that are like little mini free solos kind of. And I've put up a bunch of cool highballs around Moab that no one else has wanted to do. But I'm, setting up a top rope and rehearsing them a bunch of times so that it feels really solid. And then when I go for the real send, I get rid of the rope, put the pads out, and at that point, I just have sort of infinite confidence that my body knows what to do, that the difficulty of what I'm doing is like well within, my ability level, and there's just such joy in executing perfectly, and that certainly was the case with the free solos that I was writing about, in that risk chapter too. They were things that I had done previously on a rope, and knew that it was just, those are not cutting edge at all. They're really, for me, they felt totally secure, and I would have been fine doing them for the first time without a rope even. But yeah, I don't enjoy, I never have enjoyed the feeling of like the alarm bells going off and being like, man, you're in over your head. And I remember that as a kid too, not even in what would be like climbing context, but just kind of rambling around the Sierras and being off trail in these big granite kind of basins and just trying to scramble up, like, oh, I wonder if I could get to the top of that thing when I'm, 7 or 8 or 9 years old in tennis shoes, and then kind of like making a few moves and then realizing, like, oh, geez, I'm like way off the ground and I don't know if I can get to the top of this little outcrop. I don't know if I can get to the bottom of this little outcrop. That feeling is terrible, and it was terrible as a kid. It's terrible now when I'm, trying something hard where the gear isn't good or whatever. I don't love that feeling. I love feeling in control.
So you went, I think you just did a search, philosophy and risk, and you came, you found a French philosopher who studied risk, and du Formentel, if I'm saying that somewhat correctly.
Yeah, it's
In fact, her work's in French, so you got out your dictionary and your rudimentary knowledge of French and translated it. But
great.
she's got a very interesting, well, a hand, she's written books and stuff. But one thing that you talk about here in this chapter, risk inaugurates an other time and positive trauma. There's a couple of so, and then you've talked to people who've talked about this. Maybe you've experienced this yourself, right? Infinite possibilities as you risk your own life. This is another payoff of risk.
So I think that there's a few aspects to that. One is the idea that for the way that I'm managing risk, I'm trying to think of every possible outcome ahead of time and sort of plan and prepare for them. So I think in that sense, you are living like all of these timelines, by exercising your imagination and envisioning all of the different ways that time could fork, all of the like pathways that our infinite universe could send us down. And it does, it does create this kind of what's the word, like saturation of experience where you're living all of the possible negative outcomes as well as the sort of hoped for positive outcomes. And then I think that phrase, positive trauma, traume positif, she says, obviously is so troubling, in the context of a world where so many people are experiencing the worst kinds of trauma and in ways that they did not opt in for, and climbers are opting in for the sort of trials that we're putting ourselves through. But like I was saying before, that idea of like when you're in that hyper-attentive state, present with your whole being for an experience, you are encoding those memories with this incredible vividness. And the point that du Formentel is making is that when we're experiencing a negative trauma, that's often the case too, where our body is absorbing the horror of that experience, and it's something that we live with forever. And it's like the book, The Body Keeps the Score, the sort of like most iconic book on trauma is saying that exact thing, that lives in your body for the rest of your life. And I think du Formentel's point is that the same can be said of positive risk, where when or of positive trauma, where when you're totally present to that moment, absorbing all of those experiences into your body, and it works out the way that you do hope for, you get to live with the just infinite lushness of those moments forever. And like I was saying, the sort of precision of those memories that I have of those kinds of climbs are unparalleled. And I'll, when I'm having trouble sleeping, I mean, this is sort of counterintuitive, but when I'm having trouble sleeping, I like replay those memories in my mind of times that I think for other people it would look like that would not be soothing to remember being, 25 feet off the deck and whatever, in a terror, quote unquote, terrifying situation. And for me, it's just the calmest feeling imaginable. And I'll remember doing some of these climbs and it just like lulls me to sleep. It's really something.
You say that you feel like you've faced your biggest risk in your life, maybe on a dark two-lane highway that you didn't know. There's a drunk driver who happened to not swerve into you. So, how do you differentiate that from the risk that you put yourself into?
I mean, I think There's this great story that I can't back it up for sure that it happened, but John Backer was a really famous free soloist rock climber who was doing a lot of cool stuff in the 70s in Yosemite, and he did eventually die free soloing. But a reporter once asked him, like, why do you do it? It's so dangerous. Why do you free solo? And he's Backer said to the reporter, "You're free soloing right now," which is actually so true. Everyone is going through life with very little protection. You could die at any moment. Obviously, when you're climbing, it's obvious what's at stake. But my point with that highway thing is, like, God, I as a musician, I was a touring musician for a long time and spent so many hours on the highway, and I still do, and that is a super dangerous place to be. People die on the road all the time, and don't necessarily think of that as a moment when they're taking their life into their own hands, or even worse, giving their life over to whoever is in the lane driving toward them. That sort of counts as an acceptable risk. And it's a risk that has become invisible. But you're going 85 miles down the highway, like with a vehicle that, where a tire could blow, or where the other person could be looking at their phone or whatever. And some of those risks you can control. Obviously, you can be a good, attentive driver and not look at your phone and, obey the speed limit and be mindful of the traffic conditions and all that stuff. There are aspects of it that are in your own control. But in a lot of it, you're ceding control to the other people on the road with you. And conversely, with climbing, you really are in control of the amount of risk that you opt in for. If the conditions are bad, you can quit. And if you don't feel good, you can back off, back down, exit. And so it's like, to me, the difference is that you're really putting in the time, or I'm putting in the time when I'm climbing, to assess risk in a clear-eyed way and to manage it in ways that feel appropriate. And then so many other times, I wasn't a mountain biker before I moved to Moab. I've gotten into mountain biking with friends and stuff. Mountain biking seems hundreds of times more dangerous than free soloing to me. At any moment, you could just wreck your head, and it's horrifying. And I think if I get, I mean, again, knocking on wood, I think if I end up getting injured adventuring in Moab, it's going to be on a bike. I really don't think it's going to be on a climb. But again, people are like, well, climbing is so dangerous, you could get really messed up there. But they don't necessarily think that way about mountain biking or trail running or driving or eating unhealthy foods or, whatever it is. It's like we're all free soloing all of the time.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Brian Laidlaw. His new book out just this week is called Erratica on Climbing Language and Touching Stone. That's out and available now. Good read. Well, I'll take a brief break. Be back with more. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're pleased to have the writer Brian Laidlaw with us. He's based in Moab. His new book out this week is called Erratica on Climbing, Language, and Touching Stone. Brian Laidlaw, I had to look up erratic. So this play on words, as a good title should be, right? But erratic is a geologic term.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it's a boulder that has been delivered to its current location by a glacier. So these huge glaciers of yesteryear would, grind up and lift up huge chunks of stone, and then the glacier itself would sort of slide down valley, and then once the glacier melts, it deposits the rock wherever it happened to be. And they're called erratics because they end up in places where they kind of don't belong. They've been transported in from far afield.
Tell me about the community. I guess my first question is, is it like the Sharks and the Jets? Is the rivalry between you know, free climbers and, you know, free soloists and trad climbers and, you know, is there bad blood or is everybody in it together?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think that there's certainly no rivalry. I think that the biggest distinction these days is probably between indoor climbing and outdoor climbing. And, you know, when I started climbing, the gym was definitely like not an end unto itself. It was where you would train so that you could get strong, so that you could go outside and go climb your outdoor, like real climbing stuff. And then in the last 20 years or so, gym climbing has become a sport, like a pursuit unto itself. You know, it was in the Olympics a few years ago for the first time, and it'll be again in LA in 2028. And there are now lots and lots and lots of climbers who climb only in the gym, even at the very most elite professional levels, people who are training and performing only on plastic, on the gym holds. And I think that it's not that there's any kind of rivalry or bad blood, but I think that there is a big philosophical sort of difference between the folks who are climbing inside and the folks who are climbing outside. Certainly one of the most striking things that I've seen is by and large, a huge diminishment in the level of risk that climbers are willing to take. I think when I was first starting to climb, it was really common to be in situations that were dangerous, sometimes at least, and constantly aware of what could happen if you fall here. Oh man, you'd hit that ledge, that'd be really bad. Like, you know, heads up, don't do that. And, you know, some level of risk was just kind of built in. It was mandatory to have some willingness to be slightly at risk of getting hurt. And now with the gym, you really could climb and have no risk of getting hurt whatsoever. You got the huge mats in there, you got the belays that are like, you know, foolproof and people checking, and everything is like hyper safe. And that makes perfect sense. I mean, I think it allows people to focus entirely on difficulty and, you know, really elite level strength and movement, which is awesome to watch. I think the big piece for me that is missing from gym climbing is that, like, when you're climbing in the gym, you're climbing on holds that humans made. So it's like you're a human body interacting with a human created object. Whereas when you're climbing outside, you're using your body to react to something that humans didn't make, and sort of conforming your physical shape to this natural occurrence. And that, to me, you know, it's really the heart of the book, is this idea that climbing is not about like difficulty. It's not about combat or battling or conquering or whatever. It's really a communicative practice where you're reading the landscape, reading the rock, and then responding in the language of your own body. You know, I think by thinking of climbing as a communicative sport instead of a combative sport, the whole tone of the endeavor changes. And that's what sort of prompted this book.
At a certain point, the climbing community, your climbing community, you and your companions converge with hot tubbing. That's the wrong way to hot springs. There's a whole community that goes around finding these hot springs and, I guess, dipping in them.
Yeah. This is in the Eastern Sierra out in California, and we go on an annual climbing adventure out there near Bishop, which is great climbing zone. But yeah, there's all these natural hot springs, and we, you know, we'll do a big climbing day and then go soak in the natural hot springs. But there are lots of people who are not climbers who are just out there for the hot springs, and they are a rare breed, cool people, and very strange, a lot of them.
Now, you met a couple of Germans. And this, again, gets into the danger of some of this. The young father and son, a grown son, the younger German, had went a base jumper, right? A paraglider.
Yeah, a paraglider, yeah.
And he'd had a horrible accident after he'd landed safely. The wind caught his sail and raked him like a rag doll across the rocks.
Yeah. Yeah, crazy story. I mean, and this was shortly after I spoke with that guy up in Minnesota, and sort of before I was aware. I mean, down here in Moab, it seems like accidents happen like that fairly frequently. I got a lot of friends on search and rescue, and they're out scooping people up. But the what really stood out to me about that guy was just his cheerfulness about the whole thing. You know, he was like, I mean, he had been on death's doorstep, and one of his friends was on the search and rescue team that came to pick him up, and nobody thought he was going to make it. And you know, his dad certainly didn't think that he was going to live. And the kind of like, I don't know, the kind of casualness and even a certain amount of glee in some weird way that the guy had about it was something to behold. I mean, there's such a huge spectrum of ways that people relate to the danger that they put themselves in. And some people have, you know, very little tolerance or no tolerance whatsoever. And then I think I'm somewhere in the middle where I like to experience risk, but have it well mitigated and have control over it. And then I think there is sort of a different class of adventurer or athlete or however you want to put it, where like the lack of control or being on that edge is like a bigger part of the allure, and pushing the limit becomes sort of a necessity, because you get sort of accustomed to the rush of it. And I feel grateful that I never have fallen into that trap. You know, I think I've always just enjoyed being in control, and being out of control holds no allure for me whatsoever. But obviously that guy like had a kind of there's a vibration around that outer edge that I don't experience, but that I do understand. I don't know if folks saw the Dark Wizard documentary about Dean Potter that came out earlier this year. And it seemed like he had some of that too, where the there was like he felt most alive when he was really, really close to the edge. And I understand it. It's not me, but I certainly get it.
So yeah, some of these folks are wanting that edge and the as you described, the dark edge. Why do you do it? Why do you climb? What are you looking for?
Yeah, I think there's a few things. One of them is that my mind, at least historically, has been very loud. And filled with language. I think ever since I was little, my mind was just like running possibilities, thinking about what had happened or what might happen. And it's not anxiety at all, really. It's just like it's just active. And my relationship to language, whether it's like why I became a writer or whether it's due to being a writer, there's just words in my head all of the time, and it does definitely, I mean, I love words, don't get me wrong, but it does get exhausting. And climbing is the only thing in my whole life that hits pause on the string of language in my head. And while I'm climbing, that string of language is replaced by a similar level of like intense cognition and attentiveness, but it's taking place in sort of physical spatial relationships and not in words. Especially when I'm climbing something that's hard for me and I have to be extremely precise and really tuned in to where each of my limbs is and how engaged they are and where my weight is and all of this stuff. It is such a glorious respite to have the language quiet for a little bit. And so I think that that's a big part of why climbing has become so central to me. And then there's also just the, you know, I think the community aspect of it. You know, as with any hobby, you find like-minded people, and you know, when you're climbing with friends, you're out all day in beautiful places, and you're, you know, confronted with situations that are putting you outside of your comfort zone. And so it's kind of a fast track to intimacy in friendships that might be hard to find in sort of lower stakes communities, and even if you're just having a casual day out at the crag with a new friend or whatever, you are literally putting your life in their hands when you're asking them to belay you. And there's a level of like trust and communication and bonding that comes from that. I think I've heard it called the brotherhood of the rope. This like kind of very literal lifeline connecting you and your partner. And so I think that that aspect of it too, just the kinds of memories that you get to make is what keeps me coming back.
Let's take another break. Come back with the final segment with Brian Laidlaw. He's based in Moab, and the new book out this week is Erratica on Climbing Language and Touching Stone. That's out and available now. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Moab-based writer Brian Laidlaw. The new book is Erratica on Climbing, Language, and Touching Stone. That's out and available now. Well worth the read. So, Brian Laidlaw, I want to talk about the word crux. I encountered this again in your book. It's fascinating. Lends itself to metaphor. Right, we use it in everyday life. The crux of the matter, in rock climbing or in climbing, what's crux?
Yeah, so in any given stretch of rock that you're trying to climb, there's likely to be a hardest part where the holds are the worst or the farthest apart or the most complicated to use, and we call that the crux. Whether it's on a little boulder or a 3,000 foot big wall or whatever. Yeah, it's kind of the bottleneck where you're likeliest to fail, I guess. And the place that takes the most effort to sort out, or often it can be often it's a difficulty issue, just the hardest moves, worst holds. But it can also be a sort of interpretive crux, like trying to figure out a cryptic sequence that you need to use. And people talk about the route finding crux, where you're on a big wall and there's multiple cracks going up from a particular ledge, and you need to make sure that you follow the correct crack, or else you're gonna get sent off into no man's land or whatever. So yeah, it's the key moment.
So I was there's several moments of the book where I'm sweating, even knowing, you're alive to write the book, right? But so there's a series of there's three mountains near Boulder, the Flatirons, first, second, and third. Second, I love this. It's easy enough that a guy wearing roller skates ascended it, right? So it's not even a free solo, it's a scramble. So that's kind of pejorative, I guess. Then the, what is it, third Flatiron is more difficult. First Flatiron is most difficult. And the crux there is very interesting. No holds at all. You're relying on friction.
It should be said, these are like for climbers in Boulder, there a lot of people run laps on these things all the time. And when I was living there doing my PhD, it was kind of a step-by-step process to get to the place where I felt I immediately felt comfortable on the second Flatiron. And that became something that I would do a couple times a week just for fitness and for pleasure. It's 1,000 feet tall. It's huge, and it's just so fun to scramble up that thing. And then the third Flatiron is like a little more heads up, slightly steeper, but still these are all incredibly low angle. And then yeah, the first Flatiron mostly is really cruiser, but there's a stretch on the first pitch where, again, it is quite low angle. But you don't really have handholds that are like able to support your weight. You're just kind of in your feet, and you'd call it slab climbing or whatever, where it's low angle enough that you're not having to pull hard with your fingers, but you are having to just trust your feet in these little dishes. And it's nerve-wracking because if a foot were to slip, none of the handholds that your hands are on are good enough to catch you. You're just kind of toast. And it's like the very, very baby version of like Honnold's thing in Free Solo, where his crux, also psychological crux, was the slabs down low because the handholds are so poor. Yeah, and that, it's funny that climb the first flat iron is something that in Boulder people is like, oh, it's no big deal. A lot of people solo that thing all the time. And in the time that I was writing the essay, two different kids died soloing it. So it's both like sort of normalized and yeah, this is something that we get up to. It's just a scramble, whatever, but that kind of language does conceal the fact that yeah, people die doing this stuff all the time. So it's like it can be quite serious. It's a weird one.
Just a couple of minutes left. I want to end on this. In your chapter called Bonehead, by the way, I guess in part that comes from a you're linking up with some acquaintances,
Yeah.
and you were just happy to not let them know that you're a nerd, a writer, a poet, et cetera, just another fellow climber out there. But you get into talking about the actual stone, the actual rock, the actual mountain. I just want to quote you here. The deeper I get into climbing, the more forthrightly animist I become. I can say without reservation, I believe the rock is alive. Just give me a very short version of that.
Yeah, man. I think like the best description that I heard of it actually. So in the case of the limestone, it actually is organic matter that's been kind of like compressed and lithified. It's like seafloor muck, and actually does have an organic origin. And that chapter talks also about how, the minerals in our bones are what give us our physical structure. We have that like stoniness inside of us. But I recently came across this idea that I love so much that like if you drop a rock, it falls to the ground, and that is because the rock and all objects that are subject to gravity are aware by way of gravity of the things around them. And everything has this awareness by which it's drawn to everything else. That's sort of the most basic level of consciousness, which I find incredibly moving. And I certainly, I heard this great quote from a climber saying that he thinks he can climb harder than other people because like he believes in the gravity of his own body, like holding the rock. Like he can feel the contact between his body and the rock and the way that gravity makes those two objects adhere. Yeah, I think they're doing things to us all the time, these rocks. I mean, everybody, but especially climbers. But also the earth is just a big rock, you know?
So finally, what do you want people to take from Erratica? What do you most hope they take away?
Thanks for asking. Yeah, I think I think the heart of it is that people are interested in and needing I think a deeper way to connect with the landscape. We've like sort of slowly but surely moved into a mindset where a lot of people are using the outdoors as a kind of extended gym, and they've got their fitness tracker, and they've got their like getting their steps in, and wanting to optimize like, well, should I go on that hike? Is it worth it? Is it worth the time? There's this kind of like I would say sort of capitalist mentality and optimization mentality about the outdoors where people just like are trying to maximize or something. And that can certainly be the case in like outdoor adventure sports too, trying to climb as hard as possible or chase the hardest grade or get the coolest picture for Instagram or whatever. And like I think there's just so much more richness to be experienced by slowing down and attending to the way we're doing what we're doing and the reasons for which we're doing what we're doing, and to kind of widen the scope of our inquiry in these outdoor spaces, adventure spaces, to really meet the landscape on its own terms and learn the things that the landscape is trying to teach us, not just bringing our own human stuff out to the rocks that we're climbing, but really like treating the rocks as entities and teachers, and being in dialogue with them in a way that is like a sort of equal, non-hierarchical conversation.
Well, the book is out, available. It's called Erratica, on climbing language and touching stone. We've been talking with Moab-based writer Brian Laidlaw. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
My great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.